Thanks for listening to the Adam Carolla Show on Podcast One.
Life guru, monk, author, and podcaster, Jay Shetty's going to join us for some very insightful information that I think will bring a lot. I think it'll bring a lot of satisfaction, happiness, and pleasure to your life, but some practical advice in there as well. First, I'll tell you about LifeLock. Warning! New phishing scam. Masquerades as a billing error alert from Netflix, pushing victims to update their payment details within 24 hours of the subscription, or if they don't pay, their subscription will be voided. People are freaked out. They give them their information. The link even redirects to a very real-looking CAPTCHA form. It's important to understand how cybercrime and identity theft are affecting our lives every day. We put our info at risk on the internet. LifeLock detects a wide range of identity threats, like your social security number for sale on the dark web. If you become a victim of identity theft, you have access to a dedicated restoration specialist with LifeLock, right, Dawson?
No one can prevent all identity theft or monitor all transactions at all businesses. LifeLock can see threats you might miss on your own. Join now and save up to 25% off your first year by using promo code Adam. Call 1-800-LifeLock or head to LifeLock.com. Use promo code Adam for 25% off.
The Adam Carolla Show presents Jay Shetty's Birthday Cocktail Party for September 6th. Let's see who's here. Jeff Foxworthy. Pink Floyd's Roger Waters. And Macy Gray. Actress-comedian Lauren Lapkus. Somebody's sister, Pippa Middleton. Saturday Night Live alum Jane Curtin. Better clear a path for the buffet, because former New Jersey Governor Chris Christie is here. And, adding a whole new level of cool, Idris Elba. Let's get back to the Adam Carolla Show.
Well, author, podcaster, former monk, motivational speaker, Jay Shetty is our guest today. Good to see you, Jay.
Good to see you, Adam. Thanks for having me.
It is our pleasure. The book, Think Like a Monk, Train Your Mind for Peace and Purpose Every Day. It's available now on Amazon and also the podcast On Purpose with Jay Shetty as well. That's available on Apple Podcasts, Spotify as well. And of course, his YouTube channel, Jay Shetty, Shetty, and all the videos that have been viewed so many times. All right, so let's get right into this. I've been talking to Dr. Drew quite a bit about where we're going kind of mentally and emotionally, and how I have never seen a population with less legitimate problems that are in a worse mood and feel like they have more legitimate problems than our society in 2020. Would you agree with that statement?
I don't think I'd fully agree with the statement. No, Adam, I think that what feels like a legitimate problem is so much about perception. And we may have a factual reality, or we may have a opportunity to see what we think of as bad and rate our pain and fear and compare them. But I feel the experience of pain, even if it seems less than or more than someone else's, unfortunately, the experience of pain is so personal, and your perception can get so consumed in that, that sometimes even what a lot of us would consider small would be greatly painful. And for a lot of us, what we consider would be big would be easy to cross over. So I know monks who could deal with extreme levels of pain that most people would never put themselves into and would think of as illegitimate or crazy amounts of pain. And I know people who have struggled with smaller problems. But that's my point. I don't think we can really rate or scale anyone else's problems. I think it's something we have to do individually for ourselves.
Well, I agree with that thought. What I'm saying is traditionally, as a society, we had problems, and those problems had to do with shelter or food, nutrition, scurvy, malaria, disease, you know, angry hordes coming in trying to rape our women and kill us. So we had these kind of tangible physical problems. And throughout the history of man, those were the battles. You know, where are we going to eat and how are we going to get some shelter from the storm? And we have eliminated, ostensibly, we've eliminated those worries from our life. And my theory is we need to worry. We've removed many of those tangible physical obstacles, replaced them with air conditioning, but we've also then replaced them with more and other problems, some invisible and some unfixable. You know what I mean? So when you don't have shelter, you find shelter, you've fixed your problem. When you're worried just in general about your kids, it's really hard to ever stop because they're always out there and there's always a murder hornet around the next corner. That's kind of what I'm talking about.
Yeah, no, no. I thought we were more aligned than maybe I stated. But I read a study a while ago, it was a couple of years ago, that said that we're exposed to more trauma and pain in 24 hours through the news cycle today than we were in our whole lifetime 25 years ago. And I think the number, the volume, the incredible quantity of extremes that we're exposed to is quite a new phenomena.
Right.
And the mind and the brain haven't yet developed the abilities to properly formulate, contextualize, and understand how to deal with that. And when you were talking about problems, I believe there are two problems that we go through, and this is what the Vedic text suggests that I studied in my time as a monk, that we have circumstantial problems and we have existential problems. And the challenge we have today in society is that we're trying to use circumstantial solutions to solve existential problems, or we're using existential solutions to try and solve circumstantial problems. And so it's almost that mismatch or that lack of synergy that's what's creating so much friction in our life. Because, for example, an existential challenge. I don't know what my purpose is. I can't find out what I'm meant to be doing. I'm not fulfilled. I don't like my career or my job. That's an existential challenge. That's not solved by the circumstantial solution of, let me just binge watch my favorite show this weekend. And at the same time, a circumstantial solution of, I have a headache or I need to deal with paying this bill, is not solved with a existential solution immediately. So I think that's where I'm kind of seeing the misconnection or the disconnection.
Well, tell me if this makes sense or rings true to you, because you've sort of reminded me of this. And the one good thing about this time period we're in is I'm now open to thinking about many different things I never thought about before. So I was musing with Dr. Drew on a long walk today. Go on a walk. I talked to him on the phone, and we both try to break down what's going on in society. And I keep coming back to this sort of tangible, mechanical, real world versus an analog world versus a digital world. And the more people who have shifted into the digital world, which we thought was going to be a good thing, like get out of the coal mine, get out of the logging camp, get out from the factory and go start coding. You know what I mean? And in air conditioning, like we're going to move you from this world to this physical, tangible, sometimes dangerous world. And we're just going to move you into this digital world and you can sit and write computer code or do whatever. I felt like we didn't get the part where it was screwing with our minds a little bit, that we needed something physical and tangible to touch and fix and repair and have some sense of purpose and so on and so forth. And so when you were talking about the existential stuff versus the sort of real,
circumstantial.
Right. So, yeah. So here's an interesting thought in a sort of path to misery, because I was asking Drew, why are so many people unhappy now? And I realized, and then I would always circle back and I'd say, all the guys I know who do welding and fabrication and build, and those guys are not unhappy. They're not. And then I knew they're physically moving and finishing projects and so on and so forth. But now I'm realizing they get to solve problems all day, every day. So when you fabricate for a living or you build for a living, you start off at 7 a.m. with a bunch of problems and then you just fix them. You physically fix them. The thing that was no good is now good and ready for paint. And the doorway that wasn't framed is now framed by lunch. And we're swinging a door in that door by 3 o'clock that afternoon. But in the world of the digital, everyone is constantly trying to solve a problem. You know, we're going to solve systemic racism, but you never get the satisfaction of solving it. And what a misery that would be to physically never have a ending to this problem you're trying to solve, because the problem is in the ether.
Yeah, I can really connect with a lot of what you're saying there. I think it's a really great analysis. There's two things that came to my mind when you were talking about that. One of the first things that came to my mind was this understanding from this study by the Yale School of Management, specifically the professor Amy Wrzniewski. And they did a study. They tried to find a job that they thought would be considered tough, difficult, challenging, physically, mentally, and emotionally. And they decided to focus in on hospital cleaners and hospital workers. Mm-hmm. And they felt that this was a fairly, you know, good focus of a challenging job and a challenging role. And they asked these people to describe their jobs. They asked these people to describe what they did every day. And the majority of them replied by saying they did very low-skilled labor, low-skilled work. They basically described what was on the job description, the day-to-day tasks, and said it was pretty meaningless. But then they found that there were a group of people who actually described themselves not just as cleaners or janitors, but as healers, as supporters, as friends, as community builders, as part of a village. And they saw that these people who are doing the same exact thing on a daily basis saw themselves as connected to the patient in a much more deep and intimate way. And they coined this term job crafting, where people were assigning meaning to what they did through an intentional, purposeful mindset and felt they were part of a positive solution rather than just a functional job. And at the same time, a few years ago, I was studying Blue Zones and I got to interview Dan Buettner, who's the founder of the Blue Zones. And I don't know if you ever met him. Fascinating guy.
I don't think so. Are those the zones where people live to 114?
Correct. Yeah, correct. Exactly. So there are five places in the world. I forget all of them, but I got to visit Sardinia, which is one of them. And I remember trying to spend a bit of time with the locals there. And very closely to what you said, they all farm the land themselves. They only eat what's in season. So they're very aware of seasons and the completion of seasons and things being grown in particular seasons. They have a sense of family atmosphere. And like you said, they're actually working the land. They're building. And so I think there is a part of it that is the physical function, but like in Amy Wrzniewski's study in the Yale School of Management, it's also the mindset approach to the task that affects us as well. So I feel it's a bit of both.
Yeah, a story I tell about myself, and I'll make it short because my listeners have heard it a few times, but I was a carpenter doing kind of a job that I didn't really want to do for years and years because I had to financially. I wasn't able to make money in show business, so I basically did something I didn't want to do for over a decade. And I did it full time. And I realized at some point I was kind of fighting myself because my mantra is I don't want to be here and I don't want to do this, but I guess I'll have to do it anyway. And then Monday would come around and I'd say the same thing the next week and the next week and the next week. And at a certain point, I thought, well, this is what you're doing. So why don't you do it the best you can do it and be the best carpenter you can be? And I started getting more organized. It manifests itself in organization. The carpenters that don't care are kind of messy and their shit's all over the place and they don't know where their drill bits and drill tips and things are. But at a certain point, just through the process of organization, like, okay, the number two head for the drill index goes here and the number three going this place and here's my metric sockets and here's my standard sockets and I'll make a little battery charging station for my drill motor. Just the simple act of organization starts bringing a kind of a calm and a peace to whatever process you're in. And I immediately became much more satisfied without really getting any more pay or doing any different job simply by realizing that this is what I was doing when I was doing it, and I should do it as best I can instead of basically fighting myself through the whole process. And if, in fact, you're a janitor and you don't feel like you're happy about being a hospital janitor, try to be the best hospital janitor you can be, and I bet your happiness level goes up almost immediately, or at least satisfaction.
Yeah, absolutely. Well said. And that's exactly what the study found. And I love the experience you just shared from your own. And I've definitely found that as well. I've had several different careers, and I've worn several different suits in my life. And one of them was when I was in the corporate world, where many people have asked me, Jay, how did you stay in that much time in the corporate world, especially due to my independent, rebellious, and slightly, innovative nature? And the truth is, I learned so much. Every day I was asking myself, what can I learn here that's going to be part of my story in the future? And so sometimes you're not even getting satisfaction or contentment or purpose out of something. But at that time, it was almost like delayed purpose. And I think one of the best examples of this is Viktor Frankl in his book, Man's Search for Meaning. And, you know, he's in the most tormented place in the world, yet he is having that delayed purpose that if I'm able to do this, if I'm able to serve in this way, if I'm able to do this, then this will inspire people in the future. And so sometimes you can't even gain satisfaction from a scenario. You can't gain happiness or joy, but you can gain meaning and learning. And that plants some amazing seeds.
He's in a Nazi death camp, for those who don't know exactly where the worst place in the world is. Agreed. So let's talk about some, I don't want to get accused of what I accuse others of, which is sort of living in this world where we just talk about everything all the time and never offer real sort of tangible solutions. So my broken record plea to everyone is go to your garage, get busy, get engaged, get your hands on something, get physical and get engaged, solve some problems. And not the world's problems. Solve a couple of, put a doggy door in your house for your dog. You know what I mean? Like you take something like if you woke up Saturday morning and you have a medium sized dog and you said, I want to put a doggy door in the kitchen door that goes out to the backyard, that would immediately engage you for the entire Saturday. You wouldn't even get that one simple thought. You'd have to go to the Home Depot. You'd have to get the right size doggy door. You'd have to research what size is the right size. And you'd have to look about weather stripping and things like that. But just that one thought would keep you occupied, satisfied, and probably news cycle worry-free for an entire Saturday. Just one easy project. So that's kind of what I'm encouraging people to do. But what's your angle?
I love that. That's a great piece of advice. And if I was speaking to someone about dealing with boredom or finding out their passion or expressing themselves, I love that advice. I think it's brilliant advice. And funnily enough, as monks, we did a lot of practical work. So half our day was self, the things you'd expect, meditation, study, prayer, collective meditation. That was half of mainly our mornings. And then the rest of the day would be doing philanthropy work. We'd be out there taking care of the homeless or feeding children that were underserved or helping build a sustainable village in an underserved community in India. And so I remember literally going from meditating and being silent to actually going out there and laying bricks or handing out a meal to a child and seeing that expression. And I always find that when we can find a way to serve, if we can find a way to connect something we enjoy doing to a way that it makes a difference to someone else's life, that's truly unique. So I would love what you said. And I would say, do that for yourself. And then straight after you've done that, go and try and do it for someone else. So something that you've managed to kind of overcome on that Saturday this week, go and try and help someone else do the same thing next Saturday. And you'll find that not only does it deepen your bond with that person, not only does it deepen your connection and passion for the task, you start to see the joy it brings in someone else's life. And I think that's such an integral part of understanding everything that's happening and gaining perspective.
I think this balance you're speaking of when you're a monk of this reflection and meditation and then followed immediately with, a barn raising, that I think the people that are really excelling in whatever new world order we're in, I think these people are the people that are, if you want to know, well, how can I be successful? And I don't mean monetarily per se, although money does tend to follow it when you are. These are the people that are meditating. These are the people that are floating in sensory deprivation tanks. These are people that are doing these kind of mindful things. And then they're jumping into a freezing cold river, like after that. And then they're going to hike some extreme trail, or they're going to do that barn raising. Like, they're doing this very quiet, cerebral kind of mindfulness mixed with these sort of extreme physical challenges. And so I think we need the salty and the sweet. I think we need both. I mean, you can't just sit around and kind of meditate on everything all day. And you also can't just, you know, lay bricks all day. You have to kind of parse it out. Would you agree with that?
Yeah, I think you're spot on. I think we try and we always try and solve things like, what's the one piece of advice? Or, you know, what's the extreme we can go to? And I think both are extremes. The extreme of, I'm just trying to help the world. I'm just trying to make a difference. I'm just going out there trying to solve everyone else's problem. But wait a minute, I haven't even figured out what's going on here. And then the other side of it is that the natural extension of trying to meditate and reflect is to want to give. So it's totally true that I think life is so much more about embracing polarities and paradoxes than right. It is about trying to play in either extreme. And I think we often mistake that. I think more of us are more paradoxical in nature. You know, like, for example, I absolutely love football, soccer when I say football. But I also absolutely love mindfulness and meditation. And I think that's where you get a more complete picture of who you are when you allow yourself to have paradoxical ideas, thoughts, and likes and dislikes.
Well, if you just sort of do the math, you go, the guy who works all day stacking bricks or in the factory and never has moments of reflection or meditation, or whatever, you wouldn't want that life. And then the person that sits around and does nothing but meditate and reflect, you wouldn't want that life. So what life would you want? And the answer would be, I would want a mix. I would want the proper mixture of the cerebral sort of reflecting on meditative versus the physical, tangible. And so now it becomes about the balance. It becomes about the ratio, you know.
Yeah, and
I was going to say, I think if you err a little on the side of the physical, you'll always be safe because you'll be sort of sweating and burning calories and up on your feet and kind of solving problems. But start working on your own ratio. Like, for you, how is your ratio, if you could even think about it in those terms?
Yeah. So I would say I probably spend about 2 to 3 hours a day on my mind and body and my mental health and my physical health, whether that includes meditation, breath work, visualization and exercise and workouts. And that is probably about 3 hours a day today. And of course I spend far longer in what you're saying in the physical world of trying to do my service and purpose. But a great story that you reminded me on, which was told by the Buddha, and it's a story, and you like this because you were talking about building for our podcast. So a man comes across a river, and the current of the river is really strong, and he wants to get across the river. And he's come to this part in his journey. He's worked really hard to get here, but he doesn't have anything to get across this river. And so he could sit there and just be anxious and sad and upset that he's now stuck and he's never going to cross this river to get to his destination. Or he can build a raft. And that's what this man decides to do. He decides to build a raft. So he gets lots of bamboo, rope, ties it up together, starts building this raft, making sure that it's big enough to be on, builds an oar so that he'll be able to swing himself across, test it a little bit to check in the shallow end. Finally, he jumps on this raft, gets to the other side with a little bit of struggle, gets across the turbulent river. And when he's on the other side, he feels so grateful that he had this raft and that he built this raft and this raft helped him cross this river. So he says, I have to take this raft everywhere with me. And he straps it on his back and he starts walking with this raft. Now, as he walks a few hundred meters, what he realizes is that now the next path that he needs to cross is wooded with tons of trees. And these trees are planted right next to each other. So these tall trees, and he's trying to get through with the raft. And he can't now, because now he's trying to maneuver his way through these trees and he can't get through it. And the Buddha says the man comes to a realization that the raft that helped him get here is not the same tool that's going to help him get there. And so the man has to take the raft off, leave it behind, and walk through without the raft through the trees. So sometimes, and this is what wisdom is knowing when to get physical, when to get mental, right? Knowing when to use each of those tools in our toolkit for the appropriate task at hand. Sometimes you're going to get so much more by reflecting and going inward. And sometimes you're going to get so much more by looking outward and getting physical. And I think knowing when to do which one or being open to try both is really what's needed.
That was a great metaphor, great story, parable, whatever we're calling it. But
parable, yeah.
you were talking about visualization, easy for me, visualizing. And that's not something I've ever done, but I'm curious about it. I'm curious about the techniques of that and how it works.
Yeah, so there's very different forms of visualization. So one form of visualization can be to extrapolate the energy from a previous experience. So let's say you had a loving memory with a friend, a partner that's now gone, a parent who is no longer here with you, to be able to relive a memory and to extract the love and the energy and that feeling that you had with that individual. The second type of visualization is a visualization that can heal a memory of the past. So I know people that I've worked with who regret the last thing they said to a parent or regret the last thing they did to someone. And they may not be able to physically change that anymore in the physical world, but to relive that and to revisit that and to adjust our behavior allows that person not to change reality, but to change their experience of a situation and formulate a new reality for themselves. And the third form of visualization is a visualization which is seen as, again, being able to engage into a different space. It may be a future visualization on trying to create. And if you think about it, and we know this, everything in the world that we see today once existed in someone's mind. So that's the third type of visualization that, you know, whether it's a Tesla car or whether it's the microphone you're using right now, someone once had to think of that and it just existed as a visual in their head before it ever existed as a physical product. And so that's the third type where we're using our visualization to open our mind to new opportunities and new paradigms. So those are the three most common forms of visualization. And the techniques, which is one of my favorite ways of doing it, and it's a common technique in therapy used for grounding, but we were taught it for visualization, is called the 5-4-3-2-1 method. So whether you want to relive a memory or whether you want to capture a moment, take a mental picture of this experience, what are the five things that you can see? What are the four things that you can touch? What are the three things that you can hear? What are the two things that you can smell? And what's the one thing that you can taste? It's known as the 5-4-3-2-1 method. And so if you did that right now, if I said, you know, Adam, I never want to forget this moment. What are the five things I can see? What are the four things I can touch? What are the three things? Or if I'm going to revisit something, let me re-enter that and go, what were the five things that I would see in that room? The ceiling, the carpet, the cabinet, the TV. What are the, you know, what are the four things that I can touch? That sweater that I was wearing, my friend's hand. Getting back into that zone through that way is a really practical way to enter into a visualization.
Wow, that was specific and and interesting. I realize that because I have a very strong building and mechanical background, I constantly visualize things that I'm building, trying to solve the problems of them. And the thing that's kind of interesting is I was at a Target yesterday and I was just pushing a shopping cart through a Target. And I called a guy who's my fabricator, builder guy, and I've been trying to figure out spiral staircases, a spiral staircase that we were going to have to fabricate. I didn't think a kit would work. And we started discussing it out loud or via the phone. And so here I was just pushing my shopping cart through a Target and we're going through this thing about cantilevering and a landing and the first tread and the riser and gussets and all this stuff that sounds very specific. But I know what he's talking about and he knows what I'm talking about because we know the language. So when we're sort of talking about the tread and the riser of the stair, that's the height versus the width of the stair, and we're talking about, you know, using this thickness of stainless steel and gusseting it and through bolting it versus lag bolting, whatever. And I realized the entire time he's talking and I'm talking, I have this visual, I'm visually seeing this staircase in my head. I'm visually seeing the landing. I'm engineering, constructing and visualizing sort of at the same time. And then he's saying, but wait a minute, maybe we shouldn't go as far out with it. And I'm now revising it in my head. And I realize it sounds pretty crude and it's not really maybe a monk-like thought because I'm in a Target in La Cañada, California, talking about staircases, but it's all being visualized. And for that moment, or for 20 minutes, I wasn't really walking through a Target in La Cañada. I was sort of visualizing the staircase in my head. And it's satisfying, but it's also relieves you of that sort of monotony of just, I'm pushing this cart down this aisle and there's the soap I want and there's the beer I want, you know. And it's wildly rewarding, but it's also very therapeutic. I think if more people engaged in that visual, and you, what you're talking about is certainly more on an emotional level, but what I was doing was sort of a mechanical level, but it was still very soothing and satisfying.
Well, absolutely. I mean, some of the more, I guess, less emotional examples can also be in performance. So David Beckham would often describe how he was the England captain of soccer and he would know how to curve the ball right into the top corner. And he would often visualize the ball going to the top corner. Or Lewis Hamilton, who's, you know, number one Formula One race car driver. And, you know, he would often visualize before the track going around the bend and bending his body and visualizing that process before he's taking each corner. So absolutely, the way you describe visualization is exactly what I was saying, that the microphone, the hat you're wearing, the table in front of you, someone once had that just as a picture in their mind and how they were forming and piecing it together. And each and every one of us can live a much more pressure-free and stress-free life if we walk ourselves through a scenario in our mind. And that could be anything we're nervous about. So I know that when I'm going to speak at big audiences or coming on interviews, and if I'm feeling slightly nervous or anxious, then I know that I can just live that moment through in my mind, not from the point of view of what result I want. And this is the key. This is actually the key, Adam, from everything you said. At no point in your visualization did you visualize the result. You were visualizing the journey and the process and the work. And that's where visualization is powerful. Visualization isn't just, I'm just going to sit here and visualize that I'm going to invent the most amazing car of all time. That's not visualization. Visualization is sitting there and understanding the mechanics and connecting and piecing it all together. It's the process, not the result that you visualize.
Well, if you do a very thorough job and you're also open, you have to be open to somebody saying, oh, that's a, no, I wouldn't do it that way. I'd do it this other way, and here's why. But if you do a very good job of not going right to the end and visualizing the perfect spiral staircase, but if you visualize all the different components and parts and things that have to go along the way and potential problems that may crop up, then you will give yourself the best chance at the best staircase at the end. So it actually does. In a way, you are visualizing the best staircase by not visualizing the final product, but by visualizing all the steps it takes, pardon the pun, to make that staircase a reality.
Correct. Spot on. I couldn't agree more. And I think you've just shared exactly how we practically all of us visualize every single day. And therefore, visualization is not a weird or woo-woo or random concept. It's something that we practice extremely diligently today in different areas of our life. And by the way, we do the opposite. You know, we're also all fiction writers and start writing nightmare stories in our mind as well. So just as you're processing building a beautiful staircase, a lot of us also write negative stories in our mind and visualize negative scenarios in our head, which create more of that negativity in our day. So that's part of the process that we have. We have visualization as a tool, and we're already doing it positively or negatively all the time.
Well, you know, I now, there's something going on in this era, and I realize it's kind of dangerous, and the negative and the themes, and we're all guilty of, if someone's late, you think, oh, that lazy guy's late. You don't think maybe that person got into a car accident or maybe that person's been injured or something. We all do that. But there's an interesting thing that's going on, a bit of a phenomenon that I'd love your take on it, which is, and it happened to me over the weekend. So my daughter, who's 14, is always telling me, put on a mask, put on a mask. You can't go outside. You can't go without a mask. And I'm a little laissez-faire with the mask, I must say. So we were entering, we're at a beach club, and she was out in the water enjoying herself, and I was entering the beach club. And I brought my mask, because you got to put the mask on when you walk past the security guy, and then you take it off when you get to the beach. So there I was with my mask on and my dog and my boogie boards, and was walking onto the beach, and the guy at the security said, oh, you can't come through here with your you can't come through here with your dog. You can't come, this isn't the dog entrance. There's a dog entrance down the sidewalk. Go use the dog entrance and come through. So I said, oh, fine. So I walked around, went through the dog entrance. Later on, my daughter, who was complaining about the mask, said, I saw the security guy turn you away because you weren't wearing a mask. I said, no. He turned me away because I had the dog and I had to go through a separate entrance. And she kind of went, I know what I saw. And I'm like, oh, boy, we're living in a weird time now, because you kind of process this and you're done processing it. We see it all the time in the news, politically and beyond. And I said, let's be clear. The mask was on. There was no mask related issue. There was a dog related issue. And that's why he sent me away. Now, I know you processed it that way at the time with not much context and not really knowing the rules of the beach club. But you must sort of now flush that from your memory of, dad doesn't wear a mask, because this isn't an example of that. And her thing was sort of, yeah, but still. And I realized that's happening a lot in our society, where like someone like accuses you of something and you go, but I didn't do that, and here's why. And they go, all right, now you half did it. And I'm like, no, we should be at zero. And they're like, I kind of know what I know and I think what I think. That's scary.
Yeah, it is. It is. And I can agree with you more. I think there's a real need for us to allow people to really explain their version of what they're experiencing. You know, a parable from the book that I love that shares this in an extreme way is a story of how an evil king comes to meet a good king. And the evil king comes, the good king welcomes him like he would welcome any guest. And they finally sit down to eat their meal inside the good king's castle. And the server brings out two plates and places two identical plates, one in front of the good king and one in front of the evil king. And the good king says bon appetit or something along those lines, I guess, and goes off to take a piece, an item of food, to put it in his mouth. And just as he's about to take that item of food, the evil king swaps the plates.
Right.
And the good king goes, wait a minute. Like, why are you swapping the plates? Like, what's wrong? Is everything okay? Have I offended you? And the good king thinks, oh my gosh, have I got something wrong? And the evil king says, I just think you might have poisoned my food. And the good king just bursts out laughing. He's like, what do you mean poison your food? Like, I invited you here as my guest. And he goes, okay, anyway, let's just eat. And the good king goes to eat from this swapped plate again. And the evil king swaps it again. And the good king goes, wait, okay, what's going on now? He goes, well, I don't know. Maybe you double bluffed me. And so, you know, this is an extreme example, but so often we're projecting our experiences, what we've come across, what we've seen in our life. We project that onto everyone we meet. And we project that from our backgrounds, our schools, our parents, the way they treated us, all of these interactions. And they get so mixed that we don't give people a chance to really share their truth or their experience or who they are or what they are. And I really believe this. I was interviewing, I have a question that I ask at the end of my podcast, which was inspired by my good friend Drama. And the question goes along the lines of, you know, if you had to create a law in the world that everyone had to follow, what would it be? And I get lots of different answers, and I love the answers that I get. I'd love to hear yours. And Alicia Keys gave a really amazing answer. And she said on the podcast, she said, my law would be that everyone would have to meet someone, spend time with them, and then be allowed to form an opinion and still know that that opinion is not fully the truth. Now, I'm paraphrasing and I'm playing around with some of what was said there, but her essence was people should meet people, spend time with them before they decide who they are. And I would go on to add that, and even then not think that their version is the truth. Mm-hmm. And recognize that that was one experience. I think if we all lived right then and realized there was so much more diversity, it's more complex for the mind. And that's why the mind doesn't want that. The mind and ego want to box and simplify to make it easier to process, because this other version requires a bit of depth and you've really got to get intimate with it. But actually giving people that time and space frees us of all of these things that we'll eventually judge ourselves for. And I think that's the biggest challenge, that no one wants to be judged on first impressions without explaining themselves, but we all judge people on first impressions without letting them explain themselves.
Yeah, it's interesting how charged we are. Like, you think about, you take an image, you go back a couple of years and you take that Nick Sandman kid wearing his MAGA hat standing in front of the Indian, and you just see that image and the entire country just erupts, right? Because that's an image. Like, look at that snot-nosed little rich Catholic school white boy standing in front of this native elder blocking his path, and we all just react to it, like just dive on it. And we don't know anything about either one of their backgrounds or what the situation was or what happened before or after. We just dive. Everyone just gets triggered. And it's triggering us because we don't have a neutral theme. We have a theme in our head. And our theme is that little snot-nosed, blue-eyed kid is oppressing that elder. And we just go right there. And we just pile onto it, and the media piles onto it, and the celebrities pile onto it. And we're all just there before we found out a thing about what went on, or maybe Jussie Smollett or whatever. We just go boom. We just go right there. And if you are going to be, well, first off, don't ever drive that way, because you're going to get in 15 shootouts and road rage incidents every 10 miles. Like, it's just like you have to understand that sometimes you have to unpack things, you have to examine them, you have to sort of figure out, you also have to figure out who the messenger is. Like, why is this being fed to me this way? Why is it being presented? Why is this being presented in this manner? Is it to get me to react? Is it to trigger me? I need to hit a spot here when we, sure. When I'm done with this spot, I will. I'll tell you. I found it very challenging. The Alicia Keys. What would you do if you could make a law? Thought I'll give you my feelings on that in 1 second. First, I'll tell you guys about Bet Online, who sponsor this program. Football is back. Sorry, Jay. Real football's back. I'm talking about huge men colliding into each other with padding on and spreading the COVID. So you want to get on some of the action? Opening night coming up this Thursday, September 10th, Houston Texans at Kansas City Chiefs. That should be a good game. Seahawks and Falcons will be a good one. My Rams. Where the heck my Rams? Oh, Cowboys. That's going to be a good game, too. BetOnline gives you more options to wager and place online. Games, spreads, totals, prop bets, championship futures, and more. And you can just head to Bet Online today. Take advantage of the full, all the great season opening bonuses. Visit betonline.ag, our exclusive partner, Podcast One. Don't forget promo code Podcast One for your sign up bonus today. All right, let's take a quick break. We'll come right back with Jay Shetty, and I'll answer his make a law or make a rule question right after this.
Just $25, you get wine and gifts. Ace's favorite stuff or products from ACS. Every single month, you get the drink you choose. It's hard to beat cool stuff and booze. Adam's Monthly Nut. Adam's Monthly Nut.
You heard
It's time for another ballsy month of Adam's Monthly Nut. This month includes two Vinnie Tortorich approved and invented ultra fat instant energy packs so you don't reach for that donut. Four shot glass ice molds so you can keep your whiskey cold and straight down the hatch. A bottle of Chateau Spill to remove wine stains or blood from the fine silk you're donning. Of course, a bottle of your choice. And the coup de grace, a digital download of the very first basic cable commentary, Roadhouse. This $60 value can be yours for only $25 at CorollaDrinks.com. It's time to check Adam's voicemail.
Hey, Ace Man. Just saw a digital sign over the freeways that said, "The only cure for litter is you."
You can leave us a message at 888-634-1744.
Well, that's funny because when I was thinking about Jay's challenge, I was thinking about litter. The more, you know, I realize if you only gave me one sort of wish or one law or something I could pass, the little stuff like, you know, no graffiti or something like that is fine, or hug your kids is fine, but it probably not universal enough for me. For me, I keep sort of coming back to the golden rule. Like, if everyone just said, if my dog takes a dump on your lawn, it is the exact same thing as your dog taking a dump on my lawn or anyone's lawn. It's all the same. We don't care whose stuff it is. We just care, is it right, is it wrong? I've seen so many times, so many people, especially when you would work with guys in the trades and stuff like that, they had a very different set of rules for how they treated their tools and their equipment and their stuff versus your stuff or someone else's stuff or a rental stuff or whatever that, or the stuff the company owned. And my thing is, like, just have one mode. If you don't appreciate it when other dogs take a dump on your lawn and the owner doesn't pick it up, then you cannot do it to anyone else. And that also includes you not appreciating getting stabbed or murdered or having your business burnt down or having someone cut in front of you in line or anything. If you don't want it to happen to you, then you cannot impose it on anyone else. And if you could do that, if we could endeavor to do that, I think we'd be living in a utopia by noon tomorrow.
I think it's a great law. It's a great law, Adam. Going to have to work on that one.
It's going to take a little bit of work. Yeah.
This is an image that went viral a few years ago that sums up the exact thing you were saying. It's Prince William.
Yeah.
And you see the first one where you think he's putting his middle finger up in front of everyone.
Right.
Picture from the other side. It went viral a few years ago on Twitter and all the rest of it. Someone had posted it. And it just perfectly sums up what we were saying. You know, I think the meme had a title that said there's two sides to every story on it or something like that.
Yeah, and it's a shot that's sort of profile of his fingers. And from the profile, it looks like he's flipping the bird to a large group. And when you come around to the front side, you see he has three or four fingers up, which doesn't mean anything. So then what you do is, if you like the prince, you say, well, he's under a lot of pressure, the paparazzi's intrusive, and he had a long day. And if you don't like the prince, you go, that blue blood thinks he's better than all the people that support him, and we both just go to our corners immediately. But what we need to do is stop and say, well, let me see if I can learn more about what the context of this was.
Totally. That's exactly what's needed. It's the stillness, the space, the steadiness, the pause. And in our fast-paced environment, the mind just wants to make things up quickly because, again, it's easier. It's easier for the mind to make its mind up and move on rather than to sit there and really make sense of something. And therefore, we're better off not having an opinion about something if we don't have the time to fully study it. And I find that that's a healthier place to be than to have a false mindset around something that we have not fully studied. I remember as part of my school, I used to be part of the debate team. And one of the rules in the debating society, which I don't enjoy debate at all anymore because it's not really done in the way we were trained in it. The first rule of the debating society was you had to fully understand the other person's motion and study their perspective that they were coming from. And otherwise, you were not allowed to debate because you didn't have any grounds of debate. You were just having an ego battle as opposed to a battle of deep understanding and study. And I think that really stayed with me as a way of having compassion before having criticism.
Well, I'll tell you, because I was thinking about that as you were right, as you began describing that, I've been urging people to just take a moment when you hear about something and say, what do you think their motivation was? Why would, was that Prince Charles or Prince Harry? And
Prince William.
Prince William, sorry. And I got my blue bloods down. So why would Prince William exit a limousine to a throng of adoring fans and flip them off? Why would he do that? And now some people would go, because he's an asshole. And I go, but that's not motivation. That doesn't work. I need to know why he would do that. And now, provided he even did it, but let's just say he did do it, what's the context? Did some paparazzi hold up a sign that, you know, called his wife a bitch, or was he doing it as a playful gesture because he recognized someone he went to grade school with or something like that? Let's really try to figure it out, because it's not he just got out of this car and told the crowd to fuck off. Like, he didn't do that. He wouldn't do that. Why would he do that? And if you kind of try to get to the motivation of everything, you will find a lot more truth. A lot more. Because it actually kind of bothers me when I watch a movie and the villain is evil for the sake of being evil. I don't really buy into it. I'm like, I'll buy evil because he wants money.
Yeah.
Or evil because he's super horny or something. But it's not just I'm mean, because that doesn't. There's plenty of bad guys out there who do bad things, but they do it for reasons. They're not just because I'm evil.
Absolutely. I have a whole chapter in the book which is dedicated to intention, this exact thing. And I talk about how there are four in the monk traditions. The text suggests there are four key intentions or motivators behind every action. And they are fear, desire or results, duty or responsibility, and love and compassion. So those are the four motivators. Everything in our life, we either do because we're fearful and insecure, either because we desire something or want some result, either because we have a duty or responsibility, or because we love and are compassionate. And when you said that, actually, what you reminded me of, and I was a big fan of the movie, was the Joker movie that came out last year.
Mm-hmm.
And I felt it was really interesting to see the crafting of how they built the story up of the Joker. Of course, I understand it's fiction, and I understand that there were some potential things in it that may not have added up. But overall, it was a spotlight into how someone became that way, because you're right that in so many superhero movies or so many movies that we watch, you don't really understand what the motive is. And when you do, the villain is more powerful and the victory is even more powerful. And I think the same is true for ourselves. Like, we've got parts of ourselves that we may be uncomfortable with. We may have parts of ourselves that we try to avoid connecting with. But actually, if you realize that it's the same story, if you understand where a weed of an intention came from in your mind and your heart and your life, you're more likely to be able to uproot it because you understand it, rather than if you never find it. It's kind of like seeing a weed that's growing in your garden. And instead of going, okay, well, let me locate where that weed starts and where's it getting nutrients from and where's it going? If you don't do that, you'll never pull it out. You may clip it for a second, but it will grow right back up. And that happens in our life. It happens in our gardens. It happens in the world, where all it needs is to really get to the root of it. And you're spot on. The root of everything is intention and motivation.
Yeah, you know what's interesting, as I think about everybody, the one through line where people screw up or do something that you disapprove of or do something that ends up causing harm, it's almost always because they're lazy. It's never because they're evil. You know what I mean? They just forgot to lock the door before they went to bed and then the intruder came into the house. Or that thing they left you know, they left the burner on the pan and they went in the other room to watch TV and it started a house fire. But it's never, most of the evil ends up being lazy, end up being absent-minded, ends up being just sort of not being present. When you're doing things, it's so easy to not be present these days and kind of drift away from things that are kind of half on. And I'm wondering, in a world now that is designed to distract everybody and pull everyone out of the moment and the task, what are some exercises you could do to sort of be present and sort of present, prevent that from happening?
Yeah, I love that question. And you're spot on that, you know, we have three ways that we are almost, what's the right word? Kidnapped from the moment. We're literally kidnapped from the moment. And that is either we're distracted, either we're trying to avoid it, or we're trying to numb the feeling, right? When we're engaging with something, we're either trying to distract ourselves from it, or we're distracted by something. We're trying to avoid it, or we're trying to numb it. And some of the rituals that I learned in monk life that really apply to this to help us be more present is this theme, and there's a whole chapter dedicated to it on routines called location has energy, time has memory. And what I mean by that is location has energy means that when you do something in the same place every day, if the same activity is performed in the same place every day, that place starts to hold an energy. It's why we find stadiums exhilarating when we're cheering for our teams. It's why we find libraries interesting places to study. It's why this podcast room of yours, you've designed in a particular way that puts you in the zone to do an interview. So places have energy. And the challenge today is we eat where we're meant to sleep. We sleep where we're meant to work. And we work where we're meant to eat. So we do everything in our beds. And that's why we can't sleep in our beds, which is the one thing we actually want to do in our beds. And then we do everything in our dining room. And that's another place where we can't do everything. So one of the most important things is to define zones in our home where we perform activities specific to that space. And then you start to create a stillness and separation. So even when my wife and I used to live in New York, we lived in a 500 square foot apartment. We just had corners designated to meditation corner, TV corner, work corner, and eating corner. And even that simplification helped us understand the energy in that space. Other ways to be present, it's called the 3S model in the book. It's sight, scent, and sound. So as monks, our lives were designed by sight, what we saw, scent, what we could smell, and sound, what we could hear. So what's the first thing you see in the morning? Because remember, everything is about the beginning and the end. If you lose presence in the beginning, you're chasing it for the rest of the day. And that's 99% of our life. So 80% of us look at our phones first thing in the morning and the last thing at night. Before we see our partners in the morning and after we see our partners in the evening. You're starting your day already not being in the present. Why? Because you're looking at a notification from yesterday, a message from today, and a task that needs to be done by tomorrow. So you've already gone into the negative of presence and now you're chasing it all day. So start your day with a quote that inspires you and makes you feel present. Start it with a work of art. Start it with a visualization in your mind of how you want to progress through your morning and your day. Start your day being present and you will plant the seed of presence. Let's talk about scent. Scent is a really powerful way of being present. Have you ever walked into a restaurant and automatically you felt like eating? You felt you were there and you were totally tuned in. Why do we feel relaxed in spas? When you go into a massage therapy center, you feel relaxed because of a scent, eucalyptus, lavender, sandalwood, whatever it may be. If you have a room in your home and you inhale and just breathe in a scent, you'll feel much more present in that space through your senses. Your senses are meant to make it physical. And finally, sound. When I lived in New York City, I used to find that all I would hear all day were drills and construction and trucks and sirens. And I started looking to cognitive load and how negative sound can affect our mind. But what about the power of a song that pumps you up in the morning or the evening? What about the power of a song while you cook? What about listening to a podcast while you cook that makes you present? It's so important to use sight, sense, and sounds as ways of grounding ourselves into the present moment.
I would, great advice. I would add that you don't have to get too far up in your head with some of this stuff, you can simply have some rules. And for instance, I enter this studio, I've been doing this for over 10 years, and I have never brought my phone into this studio. I will not bring this phone into my studio. No. When you come into the studio, this is what we do. And people say, what if there's an emergency? And I go, well, then I'll find out about it when we're done with what we're doing in the studio. Or I suppose if there's a major emergency, someone can interrupt me. But I don't bring the phone. It just doesn't enter the studio. And what happens, and I've Dr. Drew does this, and he goes, I got the phone, but I'm not, you know, I'm not tethered to it. Then I'm talking and I don't hear him talk for a little while. And I look at him, he's looking at the phone, you know. And my thing is I think I may look at the phone too. So I'm not bringing it in here.
Yeah.
And it doesn't, you know, I think people think I'm telling people, like, I'm a hero. I don't bring my phone in my studio. I'm not. It's just a simple rule. It works. It's effective for me. You make some rules. It was funny. I was leaving my house today. I was passing somebody who was dropping off Starbucks at my house. And I realized I will never do that. I don't have people bring food to my house. If I want Chinese food, I order it and then I go pick it up. Or the last time I ordered Italian food, me and my son just walked over to the place, got it and walked it back. And everyone is like, have them bring it to your house. And I'm like, I don't do that. And they go, why not? You can afford it and it's easier. And you're having someone make your meal anyway. And I go, I don't know. I just don't do it. I won't have somebody. I mean, I understand Chinese takeout, but what I'm saying is it's like, or delivery, but I don't have Grubhub. I will not have somebody bring me Carl's Jr. or In-N-Out Burger. And so those are my rules. I have a couple of these kinds of rules. That's I don't watch TV before I come home at night. I just don't turn the TV on. That's my rule. You can listen to the radio. You can listen to a podcast. You can listen to music. You can write. You can do whatever you want, but no TV on during the day. You make enough of these rules. They don't have to be stringent. They're just rules that practices. I don't bring my phone here and I don't bring my phone there. Do enough of those and it'll start shaping your life. In a positive way, I'm sure. And just have a few of those. Yeah. Have them around. You know, you can have. You have to prepare yourself X amount of dinners a week. There's a rule. Go ahead and do it. I bet it starts shaping. You have to walk X amount of minutes a day. I bet it'll start shaping your life. You know, or I don't go to bed past midnight or whatever it is, start implementing a handful of rules just in a mechanical, tangible kind of way and see what it starts doing. Make a bunch of rules for your phone.
I love it. Yeah, I recommend in that vein, I recommend to people who tell me that they're struggling. And again, I agree with you, Adam. This isn't setting rules saying, oh, look how cool I am. It's rules to support someone's choice of growth. So if someone says, Jay, I'm just addicted to my phone and I'm struggling with technology and my partner thinks we're not connecting, I'd always say to people, set no technology times and zones in your home. So have literally zones in your home where in your mind you visualize almost like a laser around that room. And it's like, oh, as soon as you get there, the phone's going to stay out of that. So it could be the bedroom and the kitchen. You're like, I'd rather eat and sleep with people than I would eat and sleep with my phone. So then kitchen and the bedroom are no technology zones. And having no technology times, you may say, I don't look at my phone until 8 a.m. And you may wake up an hour earlier, or maybe you're waking up earlier than that, so that you're actually having time without that. And in the evening, okay, I won't look at my phone after 9 p.m. or 8 p.m., whatever it is for you. Those are great rules. And having no technology zones and times in your home are really practical ways of living it.
Well, another thing that's interesting, I realize I'm a freakish outlier. I don't bring my phone into my bedroom.
You're amazing. Adam, this is crazy.
I'm not trying to do anything. I don't want it to ring at 4 a.m. And
that's
then
great.
People are like, what if your dad's in the hospital at 4 a.m? I go, I'll find out about it at 8:45 when I get a cup of coffee in me. Like, I'm not doing it because I'm disciplined. I'm doing it for the opposite reasons, which is an interesting thing, which is sort of changing your relationship with that. So what I'm saying is Drew brings his phone into the studio because he's scared he's going to miss something.
And that's great. That's fine.
I don't bring my phone in because I'm scared I'm going to find something out in the middle of doing a podcast.
Yeah.
I don't want a text from my stepmom going, call me, there's an issue with your dad, in the middle of doing a podcast. Maybe I have 20 minutes left. Now I'm completely distracted, drawn, pulled out of the moment. You and I would not be having the conversation we're having if I was looking at a text from my stepmom saying, call me, it's about your dad. I'd immediately be out of this conversation. Now, that text may be waiting for me in my phone when I walk out to it in 10 minutes. I don't know. But those are my rules. And if you can sort of implement some of those, I don't know, stupid stuff. Like, just don't drive places that you could walk to in under 10 minutes. You know, just dumb stuff like that. Just basic rules. These things, they start to add up. And eventually you're leading a pretty solid life.
Love that one. That's a great one. Don't drive places you could walk to. That's a brilliant one.
Lastly, Jay, you know, this whole pandemic thing in the lockdown and all this, I feel like it's driving one group. Well, I have a theory. One group of the world's citizens are going further into the kind of lifestyle that you would preach about. And there's another group that's going further into, let's just have Grubhub bring every piece of fast food over to our house and we're just going to watch more Maury Povich. So do you think, you know, they always talk about the middle class, you know, the shrinking middle class. What happened to the middle class? I think there's kind of a spiritual middle class that's gone now. It's just a group of people that are going to be strung out on fentanyl and watching TV all day, and another group that's with Wim Hof taking a cold water plunge and then meditating and then going out and, you know, crushing Silicon Valley with their next venture. I worry that we're just going in different directions. Do you have thoughts on that?
Yeah, my thoughts would just be that everyone will be reminded in different ways of finding the best path for themselves. And having been someone who wasn't into the stuff that I'm into now, or didn't value it, or didn't really understand it, and having worked with so many people who've transformed their beliefs around meditation or mindfulness or wellness or whatever it may be, we all have our moment that makes us want to live differently, whatever that live differently means. It doesn't even have to be the kind of live differently that I'm talking about. But I think it's, if we don't grow our muscle in tough times, it becomes really hard to develop resilience for the next tough time and develop adaptability and grit for the next tough time. And this has definitely been a tough, tough time for a lot of people. And so I think once people have accepted that, once people have somewhat healed it or gone through the journey that they needed to progress, and in the beginning it may have been, I mean, you know, when the pandemic first hit, I straight away said, you know, I played a ton of PlayStation in that first 2 weeks because I hadn't played PlayStation for years. And to me, that was my way of just getting through the first couple of weeks. And then afterwards, I was like, all right, what am I doing now? Let me get back to what I really want to be doing, what I really want to be focusing on, and let me get back to it. So whatever your process time is, I ultimately think that there's going to be a way the world is going to encourage you to focus on your health and wellness, because it's all we have. And we have to listen to those reminders. And if we don't, if we press the snooze button, the alarm will just go off later at another date and at another time. And so the earlier, the more voluntarily we learn and connect to it. You know, we need to wait for our health to be destroyed to get good about our health. We don't need to wait to have a mental health challenge to get proactive about our mental health. So to me, I'm not worried about what direction people go in. I'm just wanting people to remember that we're all getting signals and reminders in our life, and let's not press the snooze button too many times, because if we do, then we might just miss it.
A good note and wise words to go out on. Jay Shetty, the book, Think Like a Monk, Train Your Mind for Peace and Purpose Every Day. It's available now on Amazon, and also the podcast On Purpose with Jay Shetty as well. It's available on Apple Podcasts and Spotify, and the YouTube channel, Jay Shetty, S-H-E-T-T-Y, is where you go. Hey, Jay, thank you so much for this very fast and interesting hour plus with us.
Oh, Adam, I had a great time. We really got into a lot of things that I really enjoyed talking about because I don't get to talk about them as often. So I appreciate you guiding and facilitating into new areas. I've said a lot of stuff that I haven't said before, so I love it when that happens.
I love that too. I love having thoughts I hadn't thought before, and I love it when I speak to someone like you and you spark in the middle of talking. I go, oh, he's reminded me of something I hadn't really thought about, or he connected some thoughts that I previously had, but I never built the bridge from one to the next. So thank you, Jay. And anytime you'd like me on your podcast, you say the word.
I'd love to. Yeah, we'll definitely do that. Once I'm through this season of my first ever book launch, I'd love to have you on. It would be great to have you, for sure.
Thank you, Jay. Appreciate it, my friend. Come back soon.
It's a pleasure. I'm looking forward to meeting you in person next time. We'll shoot at the studio.
Please.
Awesome.
All right. Thank you.
Everyone.
Tommy John, last but not least. The secret to staying sweat-free this summer is Tommy John. Summer ready, by the way. Ultra-breathable underwear and bras. Cool cotton underwear for men and for women. Like having your own AC unit built right in. Natural Pima cotton. It is for enhanced airflow. It evaporates sweat super fast. Lounge pants, lazy day joggers, soft Zoom ready tees, polos, and everything else. Upgrade to Tommy John for enhanced, super breathable designs. It's the best pair you'll ever wear, or it's free, guaranteed. I'm wearing mine right now, and I wouldn't dream of wearing anything other than Tommy John. Right, Dawson?
For a limited time, go to TommyJohn.com/Adam and get 20% off your first order. That's TommyJohn.com/Adam for 20% off. TommyJohn.com/Adam.
And the last quick 15 seconds to remind you about JB Weld. They're a proud sponsor of the Adam Carolla Show. They've been around for 50 years, and you can get JB Weld at JBWeld.com and retailers everywhere. That is JB Weld. So Tempe, Arizona, coming up, the Improv. That'll be September 18th and 19th. We're doing live pod there, and we'll do stand-up shows is there as well. You can check out my YouTube channel, see all the stand-up there, youtube.com/Adam Carolla. Rob Schneider's going to be up on stage with us the 19th in Tempe. And then Salt Lake City, Wise Guys, coming up 2nd, 3rd. I think I'm doing a live Reasonable Doubt out there with Mark Garagos. And I'm Your Emotional Support Animal is available. And leave a review. I'll read it. Until next time, it's Adam Carolla for Gina Grad, Bob Bryan, and Jay Shetty saying mahalo.
Follow the Adam Carolla Show on Twitter at Adam Carolla Show. Follow Ace on Twitter at Adam Carolla. You can leave us a voicemail at 888-634-1744. Thanks to Bet Online. And pick up Adam's new book, I'm Your Emotional Support Animal. It's available everywhere. Get the links at adamcarolla.com.